Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Utah Tech University's Human Tech Speaker Series will next feature New York Times global technology correspondent Paul Mosier. His talk is entitled Killer Robots Have Arrived, The Actions and Ethics of AI in a Changed World. In the talk, he'll explore the rapid changes that AI has brought to a surprising space, warfare. Mosier's work with The Times has explored the introduction of AI to off-the-shelf drones that Ukrainian tech entrepreneurs have developed as part of Ukraine's war with Russia. And while these innovations have allowed Ukraine to resist a much stronger foe, they've also raised a very difficult question: who pulls the trigger? A talk is on October 9th, Wednesday, 4 p.m. in the Zion Room on the Utah Tech University campus. It'll be in discussion also with Utah Tech philosophy faculty Dr. John Wolf and Dr. Emma Pendergast. The event is co-sponsored by Utah Tech College of Humanities and Social Sciences, Utah Tech Academic Affairs, and Utah Tech Speaker Fellows Program. Paul Mosier is the global technology correspondent for the New York Times, based in Taipei. Previously wrote about technology and politics in Asia from Hong Kong, Shanghai, and Seoul. He was part of the team that won the 2021 Pulitzer Prize for Public Service for coverage of the coronavirus pandemic. He grew up in Pennsylvania, graduated from Dartmouth College with a double major in English Literature and East Asian Studies. Paul Mosier, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Am I getting your name right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Okay. I guess maybe I'm curious, you... I don't know if you always wanted to go into reporting, but interested in Asia, apparently.
Yeah. I started out as a Asia technology reporter and sort of originally was based in Taiwan, actually, a long, long time ago, and kind of there sort of discovered the intersection between technology and sort of geopolitics that I've kind of pursued over the course of my career in the form of semiconductors, which, you know, back then felt pretty obscure, but now has become quite hot. But at the time, you know, sort of semiconductors is sort of in the early 2000s, it became clear that the competition over semiconductor primacy was this critical sort of aspect of an emerging kind of geopolitical competition. And so in covering semiconductors, I kind of realized I could sort of get at some of the deeper political questions and kind of geopolitical rivalries in the region. And so that was kind of a test thesis for me. And from there, I kind of just kept following technology coverage and trying to kind of use it to open up and understand kind of the big political debates of the day, and also to kind of get ahead of some of the kind of big key questions that we would sort of be facing going forward. Questions around things like censorship and disinformation, surveillance, these sorts of questions, which when I moved to China after that coverage in about, 2010-11, became a very big issue.
So this is fascinating. The title of your talk is The Killer Robots Have Arrived. Put you in mind of sci-fi. I guess that's what you had in mind, right? Arnold Schwarzenegger, his character in the yes. Terminator, this machine that's hunting down people. This is potentially actually happening in Ukraine.
Yeah, that's right. And there's a lot of, sort of nuance to what's happening. And because... one thing to realize is obviously, there are a lot of very complex, very expensive weapon systems out there being built by, countries like China, Russia, the United States, and Europe. And it's not to say that these sort of cheap commercial technologies are eclipsing those. A Reaper drone is still very much a powerful weapon, in its own. But in the past, I think as we sort of imagine these types of AI technologies coming into weapon systems, I think we imagine, militaries controlling those capabilities only, and these capabilities costing millions and millions of dollars. But one of the first things that AI has actually done is taken those incredible capabilities to, say, follow a human or follow a bicycle or follow a car in an automated way. And made them cost, simply hundreds of dollars, and made it easy to do that with a cheap drone. So all of a sudden, the kind of big change here isn't so much, that we have these automated technologies, but that these automated technologies are coming out of the kind of realm of the military into this broader consumer realm. And that means that, small militia groups in Myanmar or, units in Ukraine that just kind of want to build this stuff on their own are able to. And so that, sort of when I kind of went there earlier this year on a reporting trip, I was trying to basically see how prevalent and how good is this technology. And it was kind of shocking, to get there and see that it was, in fact, well on its way.
So you mentioned Myanmar being used there, but Ukraine, I guess, where you'd mostly reported from here. Why is this technology being used in Ukraine? What's the motivation?
Yeah, so there's a few things that make this important in Ukraine. And I guess to kind of briefly describe, over the course of a couple of years of the conflict, we've seen a bunch of different jumps in the way that drones are being used. And so, off the bat, the sort of first Russian invasion in 2022, we see drones being used for reconnaissance mostly. There's stories of 14-year-old kids going out with their fathers who are trying to defend Kyiv as the Russian troops bear down on the capital and flying, because they're the only one who knows how to fly a drone, and the kid sits back, flies the drone, can spot where the Russians are, and then the Ukrainian units are able to hit them. And so pretty quickly after from that, we jump to this dropping of grenades or shells from a drone, which you've probably seen videos of. They kind of went quite viral early on in the conflict. And so, a drone, quadcopter drone, hovers over a tank or a unit and drops a grenade onto them and kind of blows them up that way. And that's, kind of the first jump of, okay, we're getting, these cheap commercial drones can be used to actually attack. But then last year, we see this really big jump into what's called an FPV drone. And an FPV drone is basically a racing drone. They go incredibly fast, and you can basically attach a shell to them. And the way these things are piloted is with virtual reality goggles. They're not exactly virtual reality goggles, but they're basically a pair of goggles that a unit or a sort of pilot can put on and sit in a trench, and through these goggles, he sees the world through the view of the drone. And so he can fly this drone with a shell attached on it, multiple miles behind enemy lines, look around, maybe see a door that's open, fly through that door, find some troops, and then crash it into those troops, and it blows up. So this becomes almost a human-guided missile, a smart missile, if you will. And these take off in a huge way last year and become, one of the most important new weapons in the battle. And they kind of replace, in some ways, different things that are maybe in short supply for the Ukrainians. So rockets and missiles and even mortars and things like that. So these become big. And then the question, or sort of the way the Russians push back, is they start using what's called electronic warfare. And this is radio jamming that can block the drones' communication with the pilot. So, if you're trying to fly one of these things and hit a target, maybe the drone just kind of goes to static after it's 6 miles out because they've blasted it with radio waves, and the radio waves interfere with the radio that it's communicating with you, and it just falls out of the sky. And so this becomes a very effective way to block these drones and their attacks. And so the Ukrainians start kind of thinking, well, how do we get around this? And one way to do it is if you're a few miles out and you can get a visual lock on your target, to just have the drone fly itself in so that the pilot doesn't need to control it anymore. And then if you run into that jamming, it won't matter because the drone will fly itself and hit its target. They start playing around with a bunch of different companies, and a bunch of different units start playing around with the kind of technologies that I think your DSLR camera uses to do autofocus, or if you've ever gotten a drone to follow you when you snowboard or ski down the mountain, it's that kind of technology. It's this AI-based human tracking technology that uses visual analysis to follow people. And so they build up this technology, and basically over the past 6 months, it started to hit the front lines in Ukraine. And so now, if you're a drone pilot and you're sitting in a trench, you can fly up, lock your drone onto a tank 6 miles away. It sees the tank, then you say go, and the pilot is no longer in control. The drone just flies off and hits the tank. And so this is great for the pilot because the pilot can then immediately launch another drone before the first drone is even hit and lock it on something else and go. And so you start to get this almost automated swarm sort of phenomenon happening with this technology. And so all of a sudden, that really powerful electronic weaponry that Russia, again, has spent decades developing is useless. And by the way, this is the same kind of technology that's used to protect the White House, or some stadiums or other places like this when you're trying to kind of go after a drone. So the ability to get around this is a very big deal, and to do it at such a cheap level is also, quite startling.
So this is cheap is a key here, right? Ukraine running out of money. Also, I guess, can replace soldiers, right? It's a war of attrition. What about this automated part of this? Has it reached the point where the machine itself decides to pull the trigger?
Right. So the next step in this, so there's kind of a really critical ethical point that a lot of people who study autonomous weapons make, and it's called a human in the loop is the sort of phrase they use. And so the idea is that, you know, you can have a system that can automatically identify a target and go after it, but what the ethicists say is what we want is a human to see what it's doing, and once it's identified that target, the human to confirm and say, yep, go after that that target, and then they pull a trigger. And so that's, you know, the Ukrainians kind of, and the Russians are doing this as well, both say that, you know, we're doing that. You know, that's the sort of process. There are practical reasons why that makes sense as well. This technology is imperfect, so you could have friendly fire, you know, so you do want to kind of make sure that it's working right when you do this. But the thing is about these technologies is that it's basically trivially easy to turn off that human in the middle function. You know, it would take three lines of code to make it so that you just fly up the drone and it sees the first tank it can find and goes after it. And so, you know, I talked to a few people there, and they said, you know, kind of, they aren't sure about sort of fully automated technologies being used, but they're pretty certain that, like, you know, in the stress of battle at some point, you know, are there pilots out there who have said, you know what, like, we're getting hit really hard right now, I'm just going to fly this drone up, see what it locks onto, and just let it go, and kind of basically use the technology in a fully automated sense. Have they done this? Probably. You know, how much? We don't know. But, like, it, you know, it's something that's easy enough to do, and combat stress is such that, you know, in the right situation, you know, most likely that's already happening. And there's a, you know, there's a, I could maybe talk a little bit about, there's a machine gun version of this as well, which maybe is a little more kind of obvious for the sort of how the dangers of this could very quickly develop. But
Talk about the variety. There's you know, one you talked about, there is this automated kamikaze drone, right?
Right.
Locks on something. In fact, you go to New York Times, there's a video of a drone seeking out a tank and exploding. But then some other versions of this, right? So tell me about the machine gun version.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, this is a, it's sort of similar in the sense that the software being used is the same. So basically, you know, if you have a machine gun emplacement, you know, normally you need a human there, and they look around and they swivel and pivot and aim at things. And that's how it works. What these new systems do is they basically, you know, put a machine gun on a tripod, and then there's a camera there, and then the operator can hide in a trench, you know, 100 yards away. And what the operator can see is, you know, the view from the camera. And so then the next step is basically that camera is loaded with AI software that can identify anything coming over the horizon, right? So it's looking out for humans, it's looking out for tanks, it's looking out for whatever. And so the moment it sees those things, it can automatically aim at them. So, you know, let's say you have it aimed at a trench and a Russian, you know, peeps his head over the trench, it will immediately identify him, place a little, you know, digital box around him and aim at him. And now at that point, the human has to pull the trigger and actually shoot at the person. But again, it would take in that system, and again, I talked to one of the creators of this technology, you know, and asked him, you know, how hard would it be to make this automatic? And he said, literally, like, if we stop this interview now, in an hour, I could have it done. So, you know, you could very, very easily make a machine gun, you know, that sits there, and there's no human at all, just anything that comes over that horizon, it's going to shoot. That's trivially easy at this point. And, you know, could you hack it and do it yourself if you're in a certain situation, say you're retreating and, you know, the Russians are coming at your trench, and you just want to set that up, you know, you could do that. It's not that hard. And it takes us into this, like, almost like a smart landmine or something, right? Like, it takes us into this territory of a weapon that you can just kind of leave there, and it will do its thing without any human intervention necessary until it is taken out or runs out of bullets effectively. And so that, I think, maybe helps kind of show the level of, once you sort of trigger this automation, you know, kind of the situations you can find yourself in.
I want to get into the ethics of this. You'll get into that in your talk as well.
Yeah, of course.
But before we do that, this is just what, off-the-shelf type drones, same kind of drone that you'd use to make a video of yourself snowboarding, that kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what is so stunning about this. So basically, you know, it's a standard drone you could get at Best Buy. It's like a racing drone, right? So you know, you'd buy one of those, and what the effectively they're doing, there's a kind of hobbyist computer called a Raspberry Pi, and Raspberry Pi was first created to kind of help children and students learn how to do their first programming. And nowadays it's basically like a tiny little computer you can plug into anything. You know, you could plug it into a buzzsaw or you could plug it into your drone, and it has controllers on it that allow you to control how the machine works. And so what they've done is they've taken this AI software, this AI targeting software, put it on one of these mini computers, again, originally designed for kids to learn to program, plugged that into a consumer drone. And then what you have is a drone that not only follows the snowboarder down the mountain, but tries to crash into him while he's going down the mountain, right? So that's the basic technology there. So follow the snowboarder, but hit the snowboarder. So it's a slight tweak on, you know, of pretty effective technology that's already out there in the consumer marketplace. And so then the final thing is you just zip tie a bomb to that. And then you're basically, you have a kamikaze drone, or, you know, basically a human tracking missile that uses optics to track a person, or again, a tank or whatever. And so it's very, very, very easy to put together. And what's really remarkable is that, you know, in talking to some of the guys who made this stuff, you know, they said like, oh, we didn't even really have to build the software, because there's so much AI trained software and computer vision software already out there on code repositories on sites like GitHub that you can just download it on your own. So, you know, if you obviously need some technical expertise to achieve this, but you can pretty easily go online, find a fairly capable software, download it to this Raspberry Pi, plug it into your drone, and make something that does something like what's happening in Ukraine. And then it just becomes a matter of what you attach to that drone as it's going after the person.
This is amazing that that it works, right?
Yeah.
Because I think we've all encountered, the weaknesses of AI. You know, plug something into ChatGPT and it produces something pretty garbled. Although I've had some stuff come out that was pretty good too. You know, some other limitations of AI, but this particular area of AI seems to be working quite well in this instance.
Yeah, what I would hasten to say is that it works well, but it also, the point here, especially in Ukraine, is not one of 100% kind of perfect operations. The idea is, what is the cheapest thing we can use that's available to hit, hit a target, right? So the point here is, you know, this may fail 20% of the time, right? 30% of the time. But from a Ukrainian perspective, that's still great, because each of these things costs $500, or, you know, a drone costs $600. And, you know, you compare that to even just an artillery shell, which will cost, you know, orders of magnitude more. And it's like, okay, well, if 20% of these fail and 80% work, we're okay with that rate, because, even 30 of these are going to be the cost of, say, one artillery shell. So from a when you're kind of looking long term and you're thinking about a war of attrition, especially when things, you know, economic resources are limited, this solves that problem in a big way. So this is not a perfect system, and you know, more complicated, more advanced military systems are going to be much better. The things that come out of the United States military or whatever, contractors are going to be much more effective. But the point with this is, you can get 80% of the way there, 80% of the time. And for the Ukrainians in a war of attrition, that's more than good enough. That's fantastic. And, again, it's sort of similar in other, you know, in other contexts where we see this starting to be used. The point is, you know, you have usually a ragtag militia, somebody who's outgunned and outmanned, and this helps them fight back. It's almost the AK-47 of its time in a way, you know, the drone and drone warfare, because, it enables this asymmetric capability that just wasn't there before.
Let's take a brief break. We're talking with Paul Mosher. He's New York Times global technology correspondent, and he's coming to St. George, to Utah Tech University, as part of their Human Tech Speaker Series. He'll be giving a talk on Wednesday called "The Killer Robots Have Arrived, The Actions and Ethics of AI in a Changed World." And that'll be Wednesday, 4 p.m., the Zion Room on the Utah Tech University campus, sponsored by Utah Tech College of Humanities and Social Sciences, Utah Tech Academic Affairs, and Utah Tech Speaker Fellows Program. We'll have more with Paul Mosier following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Our guest for the hour is New York Times global technology correspondent Paul Mosier. He'll be the next speaker in the Utah Tech University's Human Tech Speakers Series. That's happening on Wednesday, 4 p.m. in the Zion Room on the Utah Tech University campus. All are welcome to that talk. After that talk, he'll be in discussion with Utah Tech philosophy faculty Dr. John Wolfe and Dr. Emma Pendergast. Paul Mosier, there's a piece in your reporting that really struck me. Apparently, you know, this video, you can go to New York Times, see video. I don't think there's video of this particularly, but you describe it. Drones hunting soldiers. Soldiers try to escape for a while, and then they realize they can't escape. They sit down and prepare to die. That indicates the power of this technology.
Yeah, and there's quite a few videos. The FPV drone technology that I described, this sort of, you know, way that a drone pilot can see from the drone's perspective and basically fly a kamikaze drone into his target. You know, oftentimes the Ukrainian landscape is, you know, kind of sweeping farm fields with occasional stands of trees, you know, some light, you know, hills and things like that, but it's very, very open terrain. And so at times, you know, what happens is these drone pilots will catch a couple of soldiers, you know, out on a patrol or something, right? So they're in the middle of, you can imagine, in the middle of a field. And there's not really anywhere the soldiers can go. And so, you know, these things, these drones fly at, you know, 60, 70 miles per hour. They're incredibly nimble. And these things are armed with a bomb. And so you'll see videos from the perspective of the drone of these packs of soldiers, you know, trying to run away, trying to scatter, trying to, you know, take cover. There's one where a guy keeps kind of running behind a tree and kind of, you know, like sort of juking left and juking right. But at some point he just gets too tired and he can't really do anything anymore. And the drone's just kind of sitting there. You know, once the guy gets winded, it just goes in and, you know, and takes him out. And so this is a real common thing. What's interesting is the videos, the video footage from these drones is a really sort of become a big component of the kind of psychological warfare and also the kind of, you know, fundraising process. And so a lot of these videos of these sorts of things on both sides, the Russian side and the Ukrainian side, will be sent out on various, you know, channels on social media. And then be used to raise money and to kind of create support for each side, you know, to kind of show, hey, we're winning. Here's a big victory we had. We took out, you know, these special forces or these troops in this area. And so, you know, what's kind of fascinating about this technology alongside the automation side is how it's kind of ready made for the social media era. And it forms this kind of very powerful propaganda that then can kind of be consumed all over the world. And so, you know, again, you know, you can bring up Twitter right now and look for these videos and find them. So yeah, I mean, it's a really wild thing.
So imagine these things usually get into an arms race. This is literally an arms race. Is Russia picking up this technology?
Yeah, so Russia tends to lag a little bit, but they have done very well to kind of fast follow what the Ukrainians do. The general consensus is the Ukrainians are better at using this stuff, but the Russians tend to have better supplies in the long run. And that's partially because of Russia's close relationship with China. So for the Ukrainians, it's much harder to get all these, you know, most of these drone parts are made in China. The United States doesn't really have a true competitor to the Chinese drones, the cheap Chinese drones that you know, kind of have flooded the commercial markets and are also kind of key to the war. And so for the Russians, it's been easy to buy huge numbers of these drones. Whereas for the Ukrainians, you often have to go through you have to go through Poland or the Czech Republic or something to get these drones, and then they have to get shipped in. So it's a bit of a more convoluted supply chain. But the Russians are very quick to follow. And again, there's been a lot of kind of micro innovations in the drone technology. So, you know, once you have these FPVs where you sort of fly these sort of human power, human guided kamikaze drones. Then they start adding battery power so that, okay, at first these things can go 2 kilometers, or sorry, like a mile, and then say 5 miles, and then 20 miles, and now even maybe 30 miles, right? Because they add better and better batteries, and they add, like, they'll put a piece of plywood and add an extra antenna so that it can kind of have better connection to the pilot. And then they add night vision. So all of a sudden, you can see at night. And so you can imagine the only thing more terrifying than a tiny little drone coming after you in a field in the day is, in the dark, just hearing the buzz and not knowing where it is or what's going on, but knowing that it has, night vision and can see clearly where you are. And so all of those things have been added over the past year, and the most recent of those is the autonomy. And the autonomous kind of capabilities. But yeah, there's very much a back and forth on this. And again, it kind of plays into the ethical component because, one of the great questions here is okay, this stuff is incredibly dangerous. Once this stuff gets perfected or better and better, you could see this being used by all kinds of civilians, to carry out terror attacks, to carry out, mass killings. How do we stop this? How do we get control over it? And, what the Ukrainians say to that is, basically, we're willing to do that. We're willing to talk about all these things, but after the war is over, because right now we're fighting for our survival. We need this technology. This is one of the few asymmetric technologies we have that can truly help us fight a better gunned, more numerous enemy that invaded our homes. And what's interesting is that, even the kind of, some of the most extreme people I've met who are anti-autonomous weapons, people who've spent their lifetimes arguing for treaties to stop the development of autonomous weaponry, those people even will kind of acknowledge, like, in Ukraine, it's basically not my role to tell them to stop developing this stuff because, who am I to tell them that? I'm sitting in a country that's not at war. It's not my relatives and friends who are going off to die in this conflict. And the Ukrainians say you're providing a hypothetical, ethical conundrum here, whereas I say that if I don't develop this technology, my cousin could die in this conflict in the next month. And so it becomes a very difficult thing to argue against, to say that, basically you shouldn't develop this technology because us over here in places that aren't at war really don't like the idea of the dangers of this technology when the people at war are using it, in a very in what is a very righteous war to defend their homeland and to protect their friends and relatives. And so that, that I guess that kind of gets at it a little bit in the sense that, there is this arms race happening. The technology is getting better and better, but there's very little in a way, even, if ethically you can really tell the people developing it to stop it, because it doesn't really hold ground because of the kind of dire situation in Ukraine and the need there.
It strikes me, some of your reporting, you talk about how this AI with drones is used for, and this always happens, right? For innocuous purposes or very healthy purposes, and then it transfers over to more dangerous and it gets into warfare. One that struck me was the use of this technology to, I guess, drones fly among fruit trees to tell which fruit is ripe. I don't know if I got that right. But now it's being used to kill people. And I guess the real danger here, maybe get into some of the ethics. We're close to, I guess, a world where robots, you could call these robots, don't need any human input to make decisions about killing people. So fully autonomous, and it's killing people. What are the big ethical questions that are being
So the
raised?
fruit, the fruit, the fruit. We'll deal with the fruit first. One of the companies I talked to, it's called Saker. They started off. Ukraine is an agricultural capital, and so when they first created their company before the war, and before the 2014 invasion of Crimea as well, they were working on using computer vision and deep learning AI technologies to sort fruit and pick out fruit and kind of decide which fruit is which and which ones are ripe and which ones are rotten. They were basically using image recognition for that. It's a pretty good way to use the technology, in an agricultural place, to kind of just make your farming more efficient. And then once the war happens, Crimea, they start, after the invasion of Crimea in 2014, they start taking that technology and saying, okay, we've built a pretty good fruit identification system. Can we make it identify a human? Can we make it identify a tank? Can we make it identify a piece of artillery? Can we make it identify a supply truck? And if we can make it identify all these different things and decide which is which, you know, we can then start building a really powerful reconnaissance drone, right? That you don't, you know, you can put it up there, and instead of having a human sit there and be like, you know, kind of squint at the screen and say, well, what is that? Is that a rocket? Is that a, you know, is that a mortar? I can't tell what that is. You know, the drone will use its expert kind of AI algorithms to say, that's a mortar, that's a, you know, that's a truck, that's whatever. And then the human can, doesn't have to even look. It can just, you know, immediately on the screen, you have seven things highlighted. This is all the targets, and it knows which one is which. And then you say, okay, well, let's hit the truck. And then you can kind of send off, you know, get the coordinates for the truck, right? So this is kind of very basic reconnaissance stuff, but using AI. And so as things have gotten better, and they've gotten better at using these sort of automated kamikaze drones, now their next step, and they're in the process of building this, they haven't built it yet, but what they want to do is have a reconnaissance drone that's up there identifying all the targets. So it sees these seven different things, say, you know, a truck, a tank, a person. And then they want this one reconnaissance drone to then have a kind of fleet of suicide, you know, kamikaze drones below it, and to send them out and say, okay, well, like, you know, we've been programmed because of this area, we know supplies are running low, so instead of hitting the tank or the artillery gun because they don't have any shells anymore, we're just going to hit the trucks coming in. And so every truck you see, send a drone to go hit that truck. And so you can just program that, and then it does it automatically. So every truck coming over the horizon, it's sending a drone out to hit. Or, you know, say it's destroy everything, then like everything that appears, it's just sending a drone to hit that. And so that's the next step in this. And again, you could have a human there saying, yes, hit the truck, yes, hit the truck, yes, hit the tank. Or you can get rid of the human entirely because the humans are too busy doing other things, and you just send this system up and know that it's going to hit everything you want in the kind of strategic way you want, you know, while you're doing something else. And so that's kind of where that sort of so you go from fruit sorting to autonomous targeting of different things in a decade. And that's how that technology changed, which is pretty remarkable, right?
I guess one fear is what will another decade bring? You know,
precisely.
And will we get to Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, hunting down Sarah Connor? You know, that
yeah,
kind
and
of
the
thing.
longer this goes on, the conflict goes on, I will say, the better these technologies are getting, and the more jumps in that evolutionary, you know, that innovative evolution we see. And you know, it is the kind of thing that, like, you know, this company would have just kept doing fruit sorting and other agricultural things, except that the war came to them and they had to change. And so the longer this Ukrainian war goes on, and the more that the kind of, you know, the pressure is on Ukraine to kind of evolve, and the more it's outgunned, the more we see these technologies develop. And what I'll say is that from the ethical side, you know, if we think sort of forward, right, we always think about Terminator, and we think about this like liquid metal version of Arnold Schwarzenegger that never seems to die, sort of chasing people. But like, you know, in reality, probably the first versions of something like that we'll see will be tiny little drones that are packed with explosives or something that can kill a person. You know, it doesn't have to be a human form robot, right? And so a very famous AI scientist called Stuart Russell, about, I guess, 7 years ago now, created a sort of mockumentary. It's like a fake documentary called Slaughterbots. And in it, he sort of portrays this world in which these tiny little robots with guns on them go out. Somebody releases a bunch of them, and they have facial recognition, and they can kind of figure out who they're looking at. And they all buzz around, and they find very specific people. They each have a target, and they start basically killing these people. And you know, it's all based around something people said on social media or something, right? So it's like, okay, all the people who had this political view on social media, these drones have gone out to find and kill, and they're basically hunting them based on lists of faces they have, and buzzing around them, and then shooting them, and then going to find the next target. You know, it was deliberately provocative at the time. It seemed very futuristic at the time. But honestly, where we are at the moment, three quarters of the tech, you know, the technology to do that is mostly already there at this point. And in Ukraine, we're already kind of seeing the realization of that. And Stuart Russell himself said, like, he was sort of shocked at the kind of very rapid developments of the technologies that he foresaw in Ukraine happening so quickly. And it kind of just startles him because he really did kind of in some ways anticipate the warfare that we're seeing right now. And the weaponry that again is so cheap, so available, so easy to jerry-rig together, and that can, you know, that could be used by really anyone.
Let's take another brief break. We're talking with New York Times global technology correspondent Paul Mosher. He's the next speaker in Utah Tech University's Human Tech Speaker Series. His talk on Wednesday in St. George will be called "The Killer Robots Have Arrived, The Actions and Ethics of AI in a Changed World." That's Wednesday, 4 p.m. in the Zion Room on the Utah Tech University campus in St. George. And it's sponsored by the Utah Tech College of Humanities and Social Sciences, Utah Tech Academic Affairs, and Utah Tech Speaker Fellows Program. We'll have more with Paul Mosher following this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. My guest is New York Times global technology correspondent Paul Mosher. He's coming to Utah to give the next talk in the Utah Tech University's Human Tech Speaker Series. His talk will be titled, "The Killer Robots Have Arrived, The Actions and Ethics of AI in a Changed World." It'll explore the rapid changes AI has brought to a surprising space, warfare. That's what we've been talking about. Talk is Wednesday, 4 p.m. in the Zion Room on the Utah Tech University campus. And after the talk, he'll be in discussion with Utah Tech philosophy faculty Dr. John Wolf and Dr. Emma Pendergast. So, Paul Mosher, I'm sure you've thought about and reported on the use of this technology, automated killer drones, potentially for terrorists. I imagine terrorists are interested, and I'm guessing governments are worried.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the things that I think, again, why this technology stands out from, you know, military systems that are probably more capable but very easy to control is how easy it is for this technology to spread. And so, you know, one of the stories we did kind of around the rise of drones in warfare looked at Myanmar. And you know, Myanmar is a pretty, right now there's a big kind of growing civil war there. And what's amazing is it's a, you know, fairly unconnected place. A lot of the soldiers that in that civil war are basically sitting in the jungle and in kind of thatch huts with very little connectivity, except maybe for, you know, satellite sort of Starlinks, things like that. What's incredible is that when one of our reporters went there earlier in the year, they hadn't actually been using FPV drones yet. So those drones where you can control it through the goggles, you kind of the human guided kamikaze drone. We hadn't really seen that in Myanmar yet. And when our reporter got there, she saw that the Burmese troops were actually training on a Ukrainian flight simulator for FPV drones, you know, in these huts where they were kind of, you know, preparing to go attack government troops. And so, you know, they basically saw what was happening in Ukraine, were able to get the technology, build it themselves. And not only that, they were able to get a software that the Ukrainians have built to help train soldiers in how to fly missions. And they were using it over and over again. You know, these flight simulators are very important to kind of get you used to flying these drones. They're very hard to fly. You know, basically using that to prepare to then go hit government targets. And so, you know, if Burmese troops, you know, in the jungles of Southeast Asia are able to get this software, are able to build these technologies, you know, what are the odds that somebody who, you know, lives a mile and a half from a Best Buy with, you know, extremely fast internet in the United States can do this? Well, you know, very much can. And the incredible thing about these systems is that, you know, you can just download the software, right? It's not, you know, you just need a very basic little tiny hobbyist computer, which you can buy anywhere. Then you go online, you find the software, download it to that, and you're on your way. If you have the drone and then you have some, you know, a bomb bomb to attach to it. So the availability of this stuff is already, incredibly easy and will only get easier as this kind of sophistication rises. And so yeah, there's officials, US officials that I spoke with have major concerns about, first off, the basic just, a bomb on a drone being flown into, say, a packed stadium or, whatever, at a political target. That's concern number one. Concern number two is that, we have basic countermeasures for this in the form of electronic warfare. These, again, these radio waves that you can kind of shoot in the air to block drones from being able to fly. But if you have this little extra AI bump, you can fly a couple miles away, lock onto the target, and then there's nothing anybody can do short of shooting a drone out of the air to stop that from happening. And there's just so many places in the United States and all over the world where there's just no protections at all for these kinds of things. And so, yeah, there's a very big concern right now that we're kind of, in this moment just before we see a wider pickup and use of this kind of stuff, which again, versions of this date back to ISIS in the Middle East. It's funny when you talk to people in the Middle East, a lot of them will kind of say, like, there's nothing new here. This has been going on for years. And then there was sort of early pioneering of this stuff in particular from ISIS. But, the sophistication and the availability and the knowledge that has grown with the Ukrainian conflict and then other conflicts means that, yeah, this is sort of feels like it's a problem that's waiting to, we're just kind of right at the dawn of this becoming a bigger problem.
I guess a central question is there any way to regulate AI weapons? I imagine people are thinking about this. Any movement from governments or UN or anybody?
Yeah, and there are. There's been a number of campaigns, and there's a lot of quite a few people have put a lot of resources into it. The problem is every time they bring it up, you need leaders, major nation state leaders like the United States or China to kind of sign on to them. And because every military is developing its own AI weaponry and automated weaponry, and again, a kind of arms race to ensure that they can fight each other capably, nobody's willing to sort of sign on to that. So the UN, the various UN efforts have basically every, the world's top 20 most powerful countries effectively will never won't sign these sorts of treaties. There's a lot of different things you can do. You can assure that software can be geo-locked so that technologies can only be used in certain places. You can ensure that technologies as they're developed, can't do things like target children or target say like civilian vehicles, right? I mean, there's all these ways that you can kind of build into the technology different limitations as well. But again, because this is happening outside the purview of, this is happening in a war zone effectively, like none of those things are happening, and those things, wouldn't really work there. And so, a lot has to happen, and so far nothing has basically happened to kind of control, get a lid on these sorts of technologies. And most people that I spoke with who have spent their careers doing this are quite, concerned because, again, they struggle to argue against what the Ukrainians are doing. And at the same time, that just means the technology is getting better and better, more and more capable. In a way, the genie's already out of the bottle, and it's hard to kind of put it back in. And that seems to have already happened, effectively.
Yeah, fascinating. And invite people to come to St. George on Wednesday to hear more about this from Paul Mosher. Paul Mosher, just 4 or 5 minutes left in the discussion. I want to move just in the brief time we have left over to another very interesting topic. We'd spend a whole hour on this if we had another hour. You mentioned that you've done reporting on censorship, disinformation. This is a fascinating area where there's another arms race, quote unquote, here, right? Authoritarian governments, some of them have been quite successful. China, for example, in using technology to, to put a tight lid on information. Then, of course, dissidents are trying to use this technology, including artificial intelligence, to fight back on that and get information in to a closed space. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff to there's a lot of things to talk about there. I will say on the censorship side, I always sort of am, having covered China for a long, long time, I'm sort of fond of saying one of the first great innovations of the internet age that China came up with is the Great Firewall. And the Great Firewall is the system of filters and sensors that the Chinese government uses to control what is said on the internet and to control what's spread online. And it's become so sophisticated that it's not just a matter of blocking certain things. It's a matter of being able to kind of control sort of the debate and push it and nudge it in certain directions. So, you know, if you imagine an online landscape where autocratic government controls what is said and basically can pump up anger if it wants to, like, you know, for instance, say there's some you know, small confrontation with the Philippines, you know, the Chinese government can use its media outlets and its various, you know, fake accounts on the Chinese internet to pump up anger at the Philippines so that regular Chinese people, you know, everything that goes viral, you know, shows these Philippine boats being, you know, attacking the Chinese and Chinese boats. And they can kind of pump up this sort of rhetoric so that regular Chinese people all get very angry and the entire internet kind of turns against the Philippines, such that they build a kind of natural public support for whatever they want to do there, and then they can tamp it back down again. So it goes beyond at this point. You know, the levels of control are not simply, oh, we're trying to block out Facebook, oh, we're trying to block out YouTube, we don't want like videos of, you know, a video making fun of Xi Jinping to go around. It's actually at the point where it's like, no, we're going to inflate this nationalist balloon at this moment to, you know, make sure that the people support us as we take this measure or that measure. And, you know, we see that kind of them kind of endeavoring to do this constantly, to build up support for government policies and so on. And they do it to pretty strong effect. So it really is remarkable because it's kind of the other side of the equation, you know, where, you know, in the United States, say, we're worried about these very flagrant kind of disinformation campaigns, you know, from happening. Like there, you know, the entire internet is a single disinformation campaign controlled by a single authoritarian actor that has the ability, you know, very much like pulling puppet strings to manipulate public outlook in a way that is pretty profound.
Yeah, amazing. Much more we could say about that. We'll leave it there. Just to note that we've been talking with New York Times global technology correspondent Paul Mosier. His Utah Tech University Human Tech Speaker Series talk will be on Wednesday, 4 p.m., Zion Room on the Utah Tech University campus in St. George. It's free and open to the public. And following that talk, he'll be in discussion with Utah Tech philosophy faculty Dr. John Wolf and Dr. Emma Pendergast. This event is co-sponsored by the Utah Tech College of Humanities and Social Sciences, Utah Tech Academic Affairs, and Utah Tech Speaker Fellows Program. You can find Paul Mosier, of course, at the New York Times. Paul Mosier, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
And thanks, everybody, for listening to Access Utah.